so much for that. I just wanted to bring up NASA has gotten approval to continue and complete the Mars 2020 rover. That's very similar looking to Curiosity. In fact, it has the atomic RTG radioisotope thermal electric generator attached to the that rover, and that'll be an advanced version of Curiosity. It'll be able to land in a very tight location. It's not as big of a footprint. They're going to have better control over Mars 2020 when it comes down for a landing. For instance, the parachute used to open up, you know, due to speed. Now they could also time it. So let's say they wanted to land in a higher area. They could open up the parachute earlier or later. So that should be pretty good. On board the this next rover in 2020, actually it'll arrive in 2021. It will be a sample collection device. Right now, all the rovers that have gone up have abrasion tools on the arm. The arm reaches out, goes up to a rock, and basically gets powder off, and they can take pictures of what's inside the rock. But they don't have any capability of taking a piece of a rock or soil and storing it for further investigation. But this thing will have that. They're going to have a core boring tool, which can core bore into a rock, or, for instance, to take that core sample and store it in, I think they're going to have 14 different reservoirs where they could store it and leave it there for a future mission to go out up, meet up with the Mars 2020 rover and take those samples and bring them back to Earth. So they're thinking in the future with this. Also on board is going to be a test piece of equipment to take the air, although it's rarefied, they're going to take the air from Mars and take components out of it and to try to create oxygen with this machine. So I want to see how that works. So that should be a very good experiment. Outside of all the other typical experiments of riding around on the planet, and it's going to have the laser that shoots out of the top of the mast, similar to Curiosity. It'll be able to zap a rock from 20 or 30 feet away and tell what the rock is made out of, you know, from a distance. So, interesting setup for a
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Third topic is the very brief, but Kepler. We always talk about the Kepler 2 mission as opposed to the Kepler 1, and it's been a completely different work with scientific investigation that originally it was planned for. So and then now Kepler 2 is finding planets, but also very close to Earth, where Kepler 1, the first part of their mission, they used to look, you know, 100,000 miles wide into one location. This thing is looking at the whole circumference of the orbit of Earth as it goes around, looking at all the different suns, looking for planets. And now it's been confirmed that they found 100 new planets. Let me drop it. On a completely different topic, the Orion spacecraft is the one that will eventually be going to Mars. So that's under development. But they were looking for a new type of heat exchange or a heat storage unit. So up on this Dragon spacecraft that they just sent up to the International Space Station, there's a unit that they sent with a bunch of wax inside. And the idea of this wax is to change the phase of the wax from a solid to almost like a liquid, and then back again. I'm going to experiment, see how this works in zero G, because they want to use it for future Orion. to have a storage for heat. There's a lot of heat that's going to be developed, let's say, from between here and the moon, and they would like to be able to store the heat on board instead of, you know, instead of trying to get rid of the heat with all this mechanical refrigeration type of equipment, actually store it in this wax box by melting the wax. And then when you get to the moon, going around the moon, you use your radiators that are outside the spacecraft to get rid of the heat. So it's going to save a lot of energy that's required to do mechanical operation, or typical air conditioning type of system. That I want to see how that works out. I've never really heard of this system.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And they said this box got a drawer on it. It's about the size of an old town's radio. So that should be interesting. There's other topics, Dick, but I won't hold it. We could always float those over to next week. K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
The 2020 rover that they're going to follow through on, which is an update of the Curiosity that's on Mars right now, it's going to have a radioactive thermal generator, and I knew that they were running low on the polonium that they put in there. I wonder if they are dedicating the remaining polonium, plutonium. Are they dedicating the remaining plutonium to that mission, or do they think there's going to be a way of remanufacturing some of that between now and then? That's my first question, and I'll follow that with, I'll give you another question after that one. So, where's the raw material going to come from to make that radioactive thermal generator, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Well, the Department of Defense, I believe, controls it, and they allocate NASA a certain amount of it, but they are running low on it. They got the approval for Rover 2020, and then they have the approval for the New Horizons mission, and I believe they're getting an approval for system for to operate the wheels, so no matter Mars, the body of it always stays level, well, somewhat level, a few degrees one way or the other. But it was such an innovative design that they came up with back in the 90s with that one Pathfinder went up. The Sojourner rover had a small rover, and they're using that same wheel setup. And they're all going to go with it. I see China went with it for the moon mission that they sent up, and we're going to go with it as well. It's really a very unique system, and it's very well designed. We get a lot of years.
Repeater, time out.
I guess I timed out. This is WS-2.
You're back in operation now, Cole.
Yeah, copy that. Well, look, I really like the wheel design. You know, it's amazing. It doesn't go fast. I think they said it's only 1.5 centimeters per second, but it does work well. And it was the same for Spirit and Curiosity. With the Russians, when they sent their rover to the moon back in the 70s, that had 8 wheels. And but, you know, when it comes to engineering and design, you can't beat the United States. Back you, Dick.
1.5 centimeters per second. It'd be fun to calculate that in miles per hour. It's probably something like 0.2 miles per hour, something pretty small. When it comes to the 2020 rover, I think you're saying it's going to have the ability to pick up a sample and store it, so that at a later time, the sample can be returned to the Earth. And if you look at the degree of difficulty of building something that's elaborate enough to go there, is a sky train, sky, what do we call it now? A sky elevator system, you know what I mean, to lower the package to the surface safely, and then reverse that whole process and bring something back home. That is so expensive and elaborate. I think they would be way ahead of the game to put the right kind of test equipment on board so you could test the sample right on Mars. Why bring it back home when you can construct the right test equipment and do it there? Do it on multiple samples. Let me drop it. The only exception I can think of that is that if one of your testing procedures is to take your sample and bombard it with something like the Large Hadron Collider. Yeah, this is a 27-mile circumference machine. You're not going to ship that to Mars. But other than that kind of an experiment, I think most other experiments, testing that you do in a laboratory with modern-day concepts, there might be a way of building the test equipment and sending it to Mars, and therefore use it on each of the samples. So that to go and gather some material behind a comet and bring that back home, that makes some sense. But to go through the whole procedure going out of the gravity well called Earth, let me drop it. All the elaborate procedures required to get to Mars, go into orbit around Mars, then use the sky crane to get it down to Mars, and then reverse that whole procedure to climb back out of the gravity well of Mars. Wow. I'd much rather ship the test equipment there. So, I don't see much hope in designing something that's going to bring the materials from Mars back to Earth. I don't think Earth has that many pieces of test equipment that is so elaborate and so heavy that you couldn't ship a miniature version of those to Mars. I wonder if they made that clear in Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, you won't have the SkyTrain system for a sample return mission. And my guess is this next rover, that's going to be it. That's the heaviest weight that NASA could send and land using the Atlas V rocket. So, you know, they're governed by that. You might remember Spirit and Opportunity, they came down. They were launched on the Delta II rocket, and they came down and had these airbags open, and they bounced along the surface of Mars, I was about 450 pounds. Curiosity weighs 1 ton. So they needed a different system. Would have been too much stuff with all the airbags and all. So they came up with that crane system to get what, you know, NASA right now is considered the heaviest weight. But SpaceX is gonna fix all this. They're gonna send a crewed, without a crew, a crewed Dragon to Mars. Let me drop it. Right now, scheduled for sometime in 2018. If they don't make that, it'll be 2020. So, you know, every window is a little over 2 years. But this Dragon crewed vehicle come out of orbit, and it'll use propulsion to get down to the surface. Propulsion landing. And they're getting very good at propulsion landing. Like I mentioned before, all these boosters that they're bringing back on Earth, landing on little drone ships in the middle of the ocean. Not little, but as big as a football field. And coming back to Cape Kennedy, or Cape Canaveral. So they want to be able to do the same thing. They're going to land a spacecraft on Mars in 2018. Now, suppose that's successful. You got to remember, a Dragon weighs like 10 times the amount of, Curiosity. Drop it. I think it's something like 6 tons or something. But if that's successful, 2 years after that, I could see them sending, well, not 2 years, because you're going to get the rover. 4 years after that, the rover lands in 2020. Drives around on Mars, picks up all the samples, stores it in 14 different locations. They cache every one of them. And the mission continues. At some point, SpaceX sends a Dragon pinpoint landing right next to or close to where this Rover 2020 is driving around. Rover 2020 drives over to it with a robotic arm coming out of Dragon, grab a hold of these samples, put them inside the spacecraft. Let me drop it. Now, the whole spacecraft, this whole 6-ton spacecraft, it's not going to take off. It's going to, robotic arm is going to put it inside the center of the spacecraft, somehow, out of a door or something. But in the center of the spacecraft is another rocket. Looks like a small missile that would be launched out of a submarine somewhere. Right in the middle of it. So the top of the Dragon opens up, and this missile, now with 14 samples on board, shoots right out of the center of Dragon, goes up into orbit, and then eventually, gets back to the Earth somehow. I don't know whether they have a mothership up there, flying around for propulsion, I don't know, but that's how they plan on getting off the surface back to there.
Yeah, that has some similarity to the lunar module that was used during the Apollo program. It had the great big base with its rockets that were used for landing, and that became the launching base for the rest of the lunar module with its single rocket engine to go back into space, to go back into orbit, and land and link up with the command module, and then the two astronauts in the lunar module transfer into the command module. They abandon the lunar module, and the command module comes back home. So that the minimum amount of mass of hardware is being moved in each of those directions. Early science fiction used to start off with this huge-sized rocket. The rocket would go to Mars or the Moon. The whole rocket would land. The whole rocket would take off. So without lunar orbit rendezvous or without Mars orbit rendezvous, you're bringing a hell of a lot of mass down to Mars that isn't doing anything for you, and all that mass has to be brought back up again. So it's kind of amazing that it took NASA quite a period of time to be convinced that lunar orbit rendezvous will save them a hell of a lot of original booster. The Saturn V, which is good for what? 7.5 million pounds of thrust. It would have been way too small to do the job if you didn't have lunar orbit rendezvous. Let me drop. I still think, though, that even with Elon Musk's bringing back a sample, is expensive. I think it would be cheaper to make the right test equipment to test the sample right there. I bet you there's a 50-50 chance they'll make that decision between now and then. One other thing I'm thinking about, and that is there are people volunteering for a one-way mission to Mars. And from their point of view, they're being pioneers. They're being the first to land, and the implication is they're eventually going to be setting up a colony on Mars. That I do not believe, and I'll tell you why. The people who went from Europe to North America the first time, those pioneers, knew they stood a good chance of setting up a colony and a future civilization there. Because when you go to North America from Europe, you find a beautiful atmosphere, beautiful weather, soil you can grow things on. You got air, gravity, water, food, soil. You got all the ingredients for setting up a colony and a whole bunch of people living there, and it eventually becomes what you and I call the United States. It's got all the raw ingredients. For a pioneer to go to Mars, it has essentially zero air, essentially zero Van Allen belt, essentially zero ionosphere, nothing to protect you from ultraviolet rays, what might be very poor soil to grow things on, and you really grow things with essentially zero atmosphere. And so, to think that you're going to be the pioneer that's eventually going to be, let me drop off, the beginning of a colony of people that are going to live there, and it's eventually going to become a country or a planet, doesn't have that future capability. Doesn't have that those desirable characteristics. Very few people are going to be crazy enough to want to go there as a one-way trip in a short period of time of dying there. And you'd have to be a prisoner living inside of a habitat of some kind, because the only way you can go out of the habitat is with a spacesuit. And we watch the spacewalks, and we think that, gee, it's nice and simple. You actually review all of the procedures required to put a man into a spacesuit and to put him into a spacewalk is very elaborate. And you don't want to do that day in and day out. The equipment wouldn't last. It wouldn't do it. And now you're going from being a prisoner inside of a habitat to being a prisoner inside of a spacesuit. Let me drop. And do you have enough raw ingredients? You don't have water. You don't have good soil. You don't have enough air. You're not going to grow much. The only way you're going to grow things is to create a habitat that's large enough that you're setting up a greenhouse. And science fiction-wise, you can dream about 100 or 1,000 years hence where you can do some terraforming. You can do some modification of the weather and the environment on Mars. Again, extremely elaborate, extremely expensive, not likely. So to be a pioneer on Mars does not have a future where you're going to be joined by a whole lot of other people and set up a colony, set up a country. Therefore, I don't think it's going to take place. Extremely expensive to send human beings there. Feeding them and giving them all the raw materials for survival is a very difficult continuous endeavor. You have to send tons of stuff up to the International Space Station every month or so to replace the consumables that keep them alive. To send something to the International Space Station a couple hundred miles above the surface of the Earth is thousands of times easier than sending the same amount of material to Mars. Thousands of times more expensive to send it to Mars. So as you can see, I don't think it's going to take place. People who volunteered for the one-way mission, they were in Newsday 6 months or so ago. We haven't heard much since. Have any of the space agencies still, are any of them at this time, Paul, talking about colonizing Mars? Is China saying they're going to do it and they're going to beat the United States? ZS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
China has a plane and rover to go to Mars, but no people yet. And talking about that Mars One group, which I always thought was a phony deal, and I think he was collecting money. not one country or private company was backing him. I think he was paying somebody to design a spacesuit. That was Paragon. And that was his design, and they didn't come up with anything. So, you know, all I can say is that's never going to happen. But will you get people to sign up? Yes, you will. There's all kinds of people out that would do that. But they're not going anywhere. You need a rocket to get there. You need a spacecraft. You need food. You need all the provisions that you were talking about. Will NASA do it? Eventually. Probably, I'm going to get the 2030s. And Elon Musk, I want to see what he says in September. There's a conference in Guadalajara, Mexico. All these different space-oriented countries and companies are going to go to that, and at that time he's going to make his announcement of what his plans are for the future. I want to see if it's going to include, you know, a way to get to Mars anytime soon and what it's going to cost. But right now he's self-funded, so... He doesn't have to, ask Congress, can I spend another $1 billion to make this kind of a change or correction? Goes ahead and does it. So, it's interesting. We'll follow it all the way out. I wanted to mention one other satellite that's going to be going up. 2018 is going to be busy. Let me drop it. 2018, you're going to have the James Webb Space Telescope. You're going to also have combination satellites sent by the European Space Agency in Japan and one rocket on an Ariane 5, and they're going to send it to Mercury. We just finished investigating Mercury for 10 years with Messenger, and they want to do something similar, but they just want to take different measurements. So that's 2018. And then this is other thing that they just got the funding for and approval to build. It's called a Solar Probe Plus. I remember reading about this a while back. It's going to have a different name. And the idea of this is for the probe to enter into the coronosphere of the sun. So, that's like a million degree location. They want to get very close to the corona. I think within 3 million miles of the sun itself, and they're preparing to build this thing, and it should get up to about 2,500 degrees on the outside of the spacecraft, so they have to build this thing like a tank to survive. That should be an interesting flight. They plan on launching that on a Delta IV Heavy. That's three Delta IVs bolted together. That should be good. That's going to be an interesting mission. Solar Probe Plus. Back to you.
Solar Probe Plus. Is that a 2018 launch? And is the whole reason for that to analyze what is in that solar corona? What makes that go to a million degrees centigrade? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, they want to find out why that is much hotter than the surface of the sun. I think like 10 or 100 times hotter. And also how it releases the solar particles. Not sure what they're talking about there, but they want to find out how the solar particles get released from the coronosphere. That's interesting. To slow down and get into that orbit, they have to, I think they're going to do 7 gravity assist, or I guess or gravity reductions or whatever it is. They're going to use Venus 7 different times to get to the right speed of getting this thing into where it's got to go. So it's an interesting project. We've been studying the sun forever with SOHO and ACE and all these other different, now we got a Discover out there. We had Ulysses that went into a solar polar orbit back in the early 90s. But this one's going right into the sun. That sounds cool. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the way do you add energy to a system is not obvious at first. If I've got a ball on the end of a string, and I'm swinging the ball in my hand above my head, the way I cyclically move my hand adds energy to that system, and I can make that ball in its circle on that string go faster and faster. That if I move my hand in a way that is co-phased. If I move my hand a slightly different way, I can take energy back out of it. Okay? When you do a flyby of a planet with your spacecraft, if you fly on the right side of the planet with the right trajectory, it whips you in a way similar to the way you're moving your hand, and you end up leaving the planet at a higher velocity than you entered the vicinity of that planet. That's if you do it by going on the outside and orbit on the outside of the planet. I think if you choose an orbit on the inside of the planet to orbit around the sun, you can do the opposite. You can do the slowdown. Okay, we're out here at 93 million miles. Let me drop it. If I could stop the fact that we're moving in our orbit, the Earth is moving in its orbit around the sun, something like 19 miles per second. If I could blast a rocket of my spacecraft so that it stops the 19 miles per second, then you would fall straight toward the sun. And when you fall 93 million miles, and then you hit the sun, you're going to hit the sun at a calculatable, very high velocity. I don't know what the number is, but I'm going to make a guess it's 300,000 miles an hour, something very high. In other words, we've got a hell of a lot of potential energy because we're 93 million miles from this very high gravity object called sun. Good job. So, by whatever means, you bring your spacecraft, most of that 93 million miles, you take that away and you go toward the sun, you've got to dissipate a hell of a lot of energy. Your only two choices are to do the opposite of the slingshot effect or to put a whole lot of rocket power on board. And the rocket power is very expensive, very difficult. The slingshot effect is cheap, but it takes a whole lot of time. You've got to be in the right place at the right time to go by each one of those planets on the right side of the planet in order for it to take energy away from you. So you slow down as you start going toward the sun. So that's sort of what's happening there, I think. I did a quick calculation. It said that Curiosity moves at 1.5 centimeters per second. Let me drop. 1.5 centimeters per second calculates to be something like 0.033 miles per hour. That's pretty darn slow. In other words, it takes you almost 30 hours, 29 and a fraction hours, to go 1 mile as long as you're traveling continuously for 29 and a half hours. 29.8 hours you have to travel continuously to go 1 mile. And now, is the system smart enough, autonomous enough, that as it runs into rocks and holes in the road, so to speak, that it knows how to avoid all those things for 29 solid hours when it's operating on its own in order to go 1 mile, if your target happens to be 1 mile away? I can see why you want to move that vehicle slowly so that it doesn't get itself subject to a whole lot of bumps, so it has the time to make the decisions with its visual equipment that, hey, there is an obstacle in front of me, and I have to steer around it or go over it. Drop. So, interesting velocity, 0.033 miles an hour. It's not going to break any speed records. That might be faster than some of the other things like Sojourn. I wonder how fast it moves. I bet you it moves rather slow. In the case of Kepler-2, I believe there was an announcement recently that Kepler-2 has just announced a whole lot of other exoplanets it has discovered. And I think that's an ongoing mission. Your knowledge is Kepler-2 going to be funded for some significant period of time by which it continues to find more exoplanets. And I think they're even starting to find, I think they're starting to find complicated orbits of planets that are going around binary and trinary stars. I think they found a couple of orbits around binaries,
They used to think that was impossible to find a stable orbit around a binary pair of stars. In the case of binary star, are you in orbit around one of them, or are you in orbit around the combination of them? And the same thing about a trinary star. If you've got three stars that are in orbit around each other, you've got an exoplanet. Is it around one of those stars, two of those stars, or is it a big enough orbit that it's around all three? So tell me about Kepler-2. How long is it going to be funded? And is it still finding these exotic planets? I think it's finding more and more Earth-like planets. WS2S, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think I said that before, but briefly mentioned Kepler-2. It's the extended mission, and they're looking at the, you know, looking out from the circumference of the orbit of Earth, following Earth, not looking back at Cygnus 100% of the time. So you looked at that constellation. Instead, at 150,000 stars, you know, for the first couple of years, found thousands of planets, but now it's K2, and it's an extended mission now, of course, but they'll probably keep that going as long as possible, and they eventually will be sending up tests. I think that's the end of 2017. Tests will be similar to Kepler, except a completely different orbit that they've never tried before. They call that T2. Going to go all the way out to the orbit of the moon, come back. Going to keep doing that. When it's close to Earth, we'll be transmitting signals. When it's far away from Earth, we'll be doing science. So that's tests. And then, that'll, of course, it's going to be followed up with another telescope called James Webb. But to go back, one other statement about the distance that the rovers travel. They're all about the same, about that same speed. Sojourner was like that, so it had little wheels. I guess the gearing ratio must have been similar to bringing at that 1.5 centimeters per second. Curiosity and spirit were the same, and spirit and opportunity were the same. You know, talk about traveling. I think the odometer is roughly around 25 miles on opportunity, and it's been up there since 2004, January 14th. The Spirit landed 2 weeks before. But here's opportunity all these years later, and it's really only gone 25 miles. So I guess your number was probably exactly right there. The record distance, I think, was 600 feet in one day, flat out by Spirit. Back to you. WS2.
600 feet at 0.03 miles an hour. Obviously, they're not traveling continuously. At 0.03 miles per hour, in 29 hours, you travel a mile. And a mile is almost 10 times bigger than 600 feet. So, obviously, they don't travel continuously. I think they travel as far as they can see with the camera, stop, mail the picture back home, and then choose the next path. I don't think they don't want to override the headlights, if you know what I mean. They don't want to go beyond what they can see, for fear that they might run into an obstacle. You go to the wrong place where you tip over Curiosity, so it's laying on its side. Do something, you know, dumb like that. I'm not sure there's a recovery. You have to be very careful. Let me think. Kepler-2 is a different mission. No longer staring at that one spot in space where there was many thousands of stars being looked at simultaneously. So it's looking somewhere else. By what means is Kepler-2 keeping itself properly oriented for a long enough period of time to be able to measure when a planet goes in front of that particular star, and therefore gives them a little bit of a wink out. Because the Kepler-1 failure was the inertial wheels failed.
so therefore they can't do precise orientation of the spacecraft like they used to do. What means are they using, Paul, to give precise orientation with Kepler 2? I think you've explained this to us once before, but I think I've forgotten. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, Kepler was designed with solar panels, but the solar panels aren't sticking out like wings like most of the spacecraft. They're attached to the body. So if you take a round can and put flat panels on a round Coke can, and but not all the way around, maybe four panels, that's what Kepler looks like. And they use where the two of the panels come together, they have that facing the sun, and the solar wind is hitting the panels, and it's kind of like balancing itself using the solar wind and the other two reaction wheels. It went up, I believe it had four reaction wheels, and it needs three to do its job. One failed, and then the other one failed. And that was game over. I figured that was it. But then they found a way to bring it back to life using the sun, solar wind, as a way to balance out the spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
So, Paul, are they waving those solar panels? Do they move the solar panels to present more or less area to the solar wind? Is that part of the orientation of one of the axes? And are they using the two inertial wheels for the other two axes? So are they waving one of those solar panels as the third axis of control of position? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, the panels don't move. They're permanent. You know, take a corner wave reflector, just put it out in space and take the, you know, where the corner comes together, the point of it, and point it toward the sun, and then the sun's rays will be, no, not rays, but the solar wind will be hitting the panels, you know, equally, and it's kind of like balancing itself, solar wind as it's coming out from the sun. I read a couple of articles, you know, with NASA with this, and, you know, I found it on the internet. They show, you know, they show a diagram of it. Basically, that's what it is. Take two corners and point it at the sun and try to balance it, you know. I mean, it sounds as tricky as taking two panels and putting it in water and trying to make the water keep it exactly buoyant. But that's the best way to think of it. Back to you.
You said that the test mission, which I think is a 2018 launch, is going to be using the P2 orbit. It's some kind of an orbit between Earth and Moon. Does that mean it's an orbit so large that the Earth and Moon are in the center of the orbit, so to speak? Or is it a kind of a figure eight around the Moon? I kind of doubt that one. So how do you create this P2 orbit that uses Earth and Moon simultaneously? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, they don't want the moon to interfere with the spacecraft. You know, they don't want the gravity of it. They want it perfectly pointing, but they don't want any gravity, you know, moving it one way or the other. They want it to point precisely. So, because the moon is, they want this big orbit because it's going to be, you know, traveling for like 14 days, you know. Going out another 14 days, coming back, you know, it's going to orbit Earth, so it's going to have it's really a highly eccentric orbit. Now, the reason they call it P2 is, you know, every time the moon goes around, you know, the moon will go around half the distance, that'll be when test is out at the distance of the moon, the moon's orbit, but the moon will be, you know, on the other side of the Earth, not interfering, perturbing the spacecraft at all. And then when the spacecraft comes back down around Earth, it'll be transmitting all its signals back to the Deep Space Network, and Back to you, Dick.
So once again, is the orbit so big or so carefully timed that when the spacecraft is where the moon used to be, the moon will be on the other side? So it sounds to me like it is a, you did say a P2. In other words, you've got these four different Lagrange orbits, I think they're called. So is this orbit going to be, moon is always on the back side of the Earth from the orbit of the spacecraft? Is that what you're saying, Paul? In other words, the spacecraft is going to go around the Earth once every 28 days, the moon goes around the Earth once every 28 days, and the spacecraft is always going to be on the opposite side of the Earth from the moon. Is that the orbit, Paul? K2LAW?
Yeah, that's what I read, and actually I saw it on one of their diagrams, and it was a good diagram. It was moving, looking at the time. I'm waiting for John to tell me that the clock's running up. Just looked at the time. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Yeah, it's a good thing you reminded me. This was technet number 1612 of the series that began more than 33 years ago. We're coming up on our 34th year in September. 33, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week. We'll settle a few of these things. Over to you, John. Roughly how many guests did we have on Echo Link and whatever, and chat room? KC2WGB, K2LAW?
KC2WGB. Only three on the chat room, but we had eight on the Echo Link, usuals, and it was good night. And I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and for sending the questions. And thank you, Dick and Paul. Good night. I think people had a lot to enjoy tonight. Some good questions and some good answers. Back to you, Dick.
The three people on the chat room, John, were they talking to each other or were they asking questions to you and me? Go ahead.
No, they were just signed in. There was no statements written except one thing on acquiring the battery information, that the best thing to do would be to look up some of the battery information used by the model airplane flyers. They're into batteries very big and have a lot of information on the websites about that. So anybody interested in battery information, they're saying that's a good place to get it.
Good point. There's guys that fly purely electrically powered radio control model airplanes. Some of them are very high power craft. They call them model airplanes. They're almost remotely piloted vehicles. And some of those have got a ridiculous amount of weight and speed. Misused, those things could do an awful lot of damage if they... I can see why they're always being flown far away from the audience, if you know what I mean, with a safe distance between the two. And spotters. The pilot always has to have another person alongside of him looking at the environment to make sure he's not crashing into other aircraft. So every pilot at these events has a spotter standing alongside of him, talking to him, saying that you watch the airplane you're flying, I'm going to watch the rest of the environment to make sure you're not coming close to hitting somebody. But those lithium batteries that they use, lithium polymer, yeah, I think they're lithium polymer, get an awful lot of energy out of those things. And when they're charging them, they put them inside of a gun case, a sealed metal container, because if something goes wrong during the charging process, they can make a lot of smoke and flames. Bye-bye, you all. You can say the final words to us, Paul, if you want to. WS2N, the final of the TechNet. Take your eyes if you're clear but listening.
Okay, good night. And we'll be back next week. And you mentioned in the beginning of the net, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, 135 AU, and Voyager 2 is 111 AU. Just in case anybody waited around for the 4 hours for that answer. Back to you, Dick. 73, see you next week.
That's down the road a piece. That's still around 12 billion miles, or is it 8 billion? That's a big number. Something like 37 hours round trip time when you talk to Voyager at the speed of light. Wow. And it's getting bigger. How many years is it going to be before it comes close to some other heavenly object? Paul, go ahead.
I read 40 decades. 2,000 years, and one of them, I think, Voyager 2, will get somewhere near Sirius, about four light years away, and that's near. You know, and I think Sirius is eight light years from here, so. Yeah, and that's 40,000 years. We're not going to be around to listen and find out what happened.
That's what I call a traveling wave guy. A traveling wave tube.
Yeah, there's a real pun there. A traveling wave tube. Boy, is it traveling. Now, that traveling wave tube has been in continuous service, per se, for 37 years. 40,000 years, not a chance. And the plutonium that's on board that radioactive thermal generator, what's the half-life of that plutonium pool? And it's also slowly eating up its thermal couples, isn't that true? So it's continuously going down in power output. So we're not going to be talking to it much beyond, let me pick a number, 2025 or so. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think plutonium 239 was 84 years, half life, and that's the problem. Our storage of this stuff here on Earth, but you know, it's degrading as we speak. So they better use it up quick for the next couple of space shots. They're not making any more.
As we decommission missiles, don't we recover some of that plutonium, Paul? Go ahead.
No, it's a byproduct of the making of the all the nuclear bombs. That's what I understand.
I thought there was a seed of plutonium in the center of many of those nuclear bombs. So there's no longer any beep bubble. Bye bye for now. See you guys later.
We'll cover it next week. 73. Have a good night.
KT2WGB, KT2UPS.
KT2UPS. Good morning, Rich.
It is after midnight, so I guess it is good morning now. Just a question, have you ever come across TL-259s that were not threaded the same as a normal one would be? I don't know what the thread count is, but I ran into a situation where I was trying to join two pieces of coax, and the guy had a, I don't know, it was like a 3 or 4 inch long, like a bulkhead fitting, you know, for going through something, but he was just going to use it to connect the two pieces. And it looked like there were, you know, standard threads on both ends, but I tried four different brands of PL-259s, and they would all give maybe a maximum of one rotation onto it, nowhere near enough to pull it up tight. I went out and got a barrel connector out of my car, and that one worked, but I did not, I was not aware that there was different threads on some of those things, unless it was just like a Chinese or metric one or something, but I never heard of that.
It must have been brand X, because the thread is supposed to be 3/8 of 24. A UHF connector and a type N connector. Thread is 3/8 of 24. Over to you, John.
Yes, that's what I understand the correct thread is. But I know there are different PL-259s, and if you look at the pin and mic that pin up, the length and diameter of the pin is different on some of them that have a different threaded ferrule. So that may have been the issue. I don't know if it was marked. It probably wasn't an Amphenol, but some of the oddball connectors I know were made for special applications.
Okay, well, there was no markings on this at all that I could tell. And from what I remember, it was roughly 3, maybe 4 inches maximum long. The entire thing was threaded. There was no, like, smooth part in the middle or anything like that. And it had two large nuts on it for, you know, tightening it up against the bulkhead, I guess. But, you know, the fittings, I could push them in so that the center pin of the PL-259 was fully inserted into it, and you can actually look through it and see the hole straight through right down the middle. But as soon as I tried to turn the shell of the PL-259 connectors on it, none of them go more than one turn. And I had never come across one before that it was like that, but there was no markings on it at all, so I don't know where it came from.
It would be of interest to look at that thread carefully, because it's possible. possible that could have been a metric thread inside that. I know they do make a metric one. I don't know if it's sold in this country or not, but I have seen some metric ones. Also ends that were metric.
Oh, that's what I thought, because when I couldn't get the one side to go on, I thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with the thread of the bulkhead connector, but there didn't seem to be any marring in the threads at all, you know, no dings, no deformation of the threads, and I tried, like I said, four different brands of PL-259 to try to get onto the thing, and none of them worked. They all did the exact same thing, so that's something, I guess, to watch out for when you're buying pieces, you know, make sure you get a reputable brands and, you know, from the U.S. manufacturers. But that was a first for me coming across then.
Rich, you needed a bigger Stilson wrench. That's what they do, what the union people do. Just use the bigger wrench. Close your chart.
Yeah, exactly. Pipe wrench. Thread it on, get it to spin. But, yeah, it's unusual, but I have run into that situation with equipment that had what looked like PL-259s or end connectors on them, but the external thread on the connector was metric. So there's a lot of crazy stuff out there. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KTUPS mobile. I was just redoing a coax run at a friend's house, and he had the pieces there. He had the PL-259s, and then he had this bulkhead fitting or bulkhead feed-through connector. So I don't think he had taken it off of anything else. I don't know if he got it at a flea market or possibly on the job somewhere. That I'm not really sure of its origin, but I'm pretty sure there was no markings on it. Although if I go back there, I'll really go over it carefully and see, maybe in the end, like in the dielectric part, it might be stamped with a name or a number. But it was just funny. I mean, I for half a second I did think about taking a wrench and kind of force it on. I said, no, I'll just destroy the connector that way and strip it, and then I'll have to put new PL-259 on too. So that would just make my problem worse.
Yeah, the only way to check that for sure would be with the thread gauge. And I'm sure you don't have one of those, but something like that. Or if you have a collection of nuts about that size, you see if you can get something to spin on there. But also, I don't know if you have a tap and die set, and take one of the keys and see if that'll thread on. And maybe you can find something that would fit, and then you will know exactly what the pitch is.
And I'm familiar with all of those tools, but I don't own any of those myself. So I figured it was just most likely a metric thread. I'm thinking it came from overseas somewhere. Because all the connectors turned the exact almost one full rotation, and that was it. So the threads were close, but not close enough. So, I was just figured I would ask if you've come across that before. But interesting net tonight. Fascinating space report too. That stuff is getting very interesting. And I know earlier too, I had wanted to mention that when Dick was mentioning about the electric cars and Tesla, there's two companies. Tesla is one, building a Class 8 tractor trailer that is electric, and there's another company, a startup, I think they're based out in Utah or Nevada, and they're called Nikola, N-I-K-O-L-A, kind of a takeoff on